Well, good morning. Welcome, everybody. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, June 14, 2011. We want to welcome all of you who joined us in person or listening to the webcast. The board will today consider a recommendation to adopt a temporary rule related to an interim inspection program for broker-dealer audits, and a recommendation to adopt rules related to assessing and collecting a portion of the board's accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund our oversight of audits of brokers and dealers and amendments to the funding rules for issuers. Before we proceed with the agenda, I want to note for the record that all board members are present. The first order of business before the board is a staff recommendation that the board adopt a temporary rule to establish an interim inspection program related to audits of brokers and dealers. And to present the staff's recommendation on this agenda item, I want to turn to our general counsel, Mr. Seymour, Gordon Seymour.
Thank you, Chairman Doty, members of the board. On behalf of the Office of General Counsel, I'm pleased to recommend that the board today adopt a temporary rule to commence an interim program of inspection of broker-dealer audits. The Dodd-Frank Act of 2002 authorizes the board to carry out the same oversight responsibilities with respect to audits of securities brokers and dealers as the board carries out today with respect to public company audits. This, of course, includes setting audit standards, conducting a program of regular inspections to assess auditors' compliance with laws, rules, and standards, and, where appropriate, conducting investigations and commencing disciplinary proceedings. We're here today to recommend that the board begin to implement this new authority by adopting rules that would establish an interim program of inspection of broker-dealer audits. Michael Stevenson, Deputy General Counsel, will present the staff's recommendation. Before he does so, though, I want to briefly thank Michael and Jennifer Williams from the Office of General Counsel for their thoughtful and careful work on this proposal. I also want to acknowledge the very substantial assistance we've received from Helen Munter, Bob Madej, and others in our inspections division. With that, let me turn things over to Michael to present the recommendation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I'm here this morning with Jennifer Williams, my colleague in the Office of General Counsel, Helen Munter, the Director of the Division of Registration and Inspections, and Bob Madej, Regional Associate Director in the division. And as Gordon said, we're recommending this morning that the board adopt a temporary rule to establish an interim inspection program related to audits of brokers and dealers. It would be PCAOB Rule 4020T. The board proposed a version of this rule in December and sought public comment on the proposal. The board received 12 comment letters, including two letters from members of Congress. Commenters raised a variety of issues, and they're all addressed in the release that we're recommending today, and I'll discuss some of them in my remarks this morning. I'd like to begin with some brief background and then cover three areas: the scope of the registered public accounting firms included in the inspection program, a little bit about the inspection process itself, and then the board's reporting on the inspection process. By way of background, the Dodd-Frank amendments to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act authorize the board to inspect auditors of broker-dealers, but to do so, the board must first establish an inspection program by rule. The Act does not prescribe the elements of that inspection program and instead leaves it to the board to resolve some important questions about the program. For example, the Act provides that the board's inspection program may allow for differentiation among classes of brokers and dealers. A more narrowly focused provision of the Act requires that the board consider whether differing inspection schedules would be appropriate with respect to auditors that issue audit reports only for brokers or dealers that do not receive, handle, or hold customer securities or cash, so-called introducing brokers, or are not members of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. The Act permits the board to differentiate in the inspection program, even to the extent of completely excluding some categories of broker-dealer auditors from the inspection requirement. Doing so would also have the effect of exempting those firms from the requirement to be registered with the PCAOB, and thus from any PCAOB oversight. The board's December proposal, however, did not reflect any exercise of this authority to differentiate among auditors or to exempt auditors from the inspection program. Rather, the board proposed a temporary rule for an inclusive interim inspection program. The proposal explained that this would serve two purposes. First, it would allow the board to begin to exercise its new inspection authority without delay. And second, it would allow the board to gather information that could help to inform decisions about whether eventually to exempt any auditors from a permanent inspection program. The board received a number of comments addressing the inclusive scope of the proposed interim program. Some commenters supported the proposed scope, while nevertheless suggesting that the board focus its interim inspection efforts on audits of certain categories of brokers and dealers, such as those that have possession and control of customer cash or securities. Other commenters disagreed with the proposed approach. They argued that certain categories of brokers and dealers pose little or no risk to the investing public. They suggested that the board could identify those categories now by focusing on factors such as whether the broker or dealer has custody of or meaningful access to client assets, or whether it is exclusively an introducing broker. These commenters suggested that the board either should exempt the auditors of low-risk categories of firms from the board's authority without delay, or should collect and study currently available data on the question before subjecting auditors of all brokers and dealers to an inspection program. The commenters expressed concern that costs related to PCAOB regulation of such broker-dealers' auditors could be a significant burden, with no corresponding contribution to meaningful protection of investors. All of these comments have been carefully considered, and our recommendation today is that the board adopt a temporary rule for an interim program of the same scope as proposed, without excluding any registered firms at this time. I do want to emphasize a couple of points about that, though. First, the inclusive scope of the interim program should not be construed as necessarily foreshadowing the likely scope of a permanent program. The release notes that the board anticipates carefully considering whether there should be exemptions from the permanent program, and that the board expects to give consideration to, among other things, whether a broker's or dealer's meaningful access to client assets is a relevant factor in determining the investor protection and public interest benefits of PCAOB oversight of the auditor of that broker or dealer. Second, the inclusive scope of the interim program does not mean that every broker or dealer auditor will be inspected as part of the interim program. The release explains that the board expects to be able to gather the information necessary to inform its consideration of a permanent program without having to inspect most broker dealer auditors during the interim program. It is likely that only a relatively few auditors whose broker-dealer audit practice is limited to introducing broker-dealers will be inspected. But the premise of the recommendation to adopt a temporary rule for an inclusive interim program is that some such inspection work will be useful. Establishing a permanent program that appropriately protects investors and furthers the public interest will involve consideration of whether and how the conduct of registered firms in different categories might affect investors and threaten the public interest, as well as consideration of costs and regulatory burdens on different categories of registered public accounting firms and classes of brokers and dealers. The board will be better informed and in a better position to make judgments on these issues at a later date. In the meantime, a temporary rule establishing an interim program allows the board to begin assessing registered public accounting firms' audits of brokers and dealers, including audits and auditors that no one would argue the board should exempt from the inspection program, without delaying all such work until final resolution on the scope of a permanent program. Let me turn briefly to the substance of the inspection process. The focus of procedures in the interim program will be on assessing compliance with the standards and rules that govern the auditor's work at the time that work is performed. Although the board now has the authority to set, subject to SEC approval, standards for broker-dealer audits, the board has not yet done so, and this temporary rule does not do so. The release cites guidance that the SEC and its staff provided late last year regarding standards and rules that currently govern broker-dealer audits. The release also points out that for audits performed under the standards and rules that currently apply, inspection procedures would take appropriate account of the interpretive guidance in the AICPA broker-dealer audit guide. As with any board inspection, the inspection procedures will involve identifying audit deficiencies and bringing them to the firm's attention with the expectation that the firm will address the deficiencies and take steps to avoid future such deficiencies. The board will also report to the SEC and could report to FINRA and certain other authorities information suggesting violations of law or rules by brokers and dealers. Inspection procedures performed in the interim program will be in accordance with and subject to the provisions of Section 104 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Among other things, this means that the Act's provisions concerning the confidentiality of inspection information will apply to the interim program. In addition, if appropriate, information obtained through the interim program could lead to the PCAOB imposing disciplinary sanctions against a registered public accounting firm or its associated persons. With that in mind, the rule that we recommend today amends the definitions of certain terms that are used in the board's enforcement rules so that they will conform with the Act's new definitions of those terms and encompass broker-dealer audits. Temporary rule addresses the question of reporting on inspection procedures by providing that no less frequently than every 12 months during the interim program, the board will publish a report on the interim program. Each report will describe the progress of the interim program and any significant observations. Each report will be a general report covering inspection procedures at many firms, and like the general reports that the board has issued under its Rule 4010, would not identify specific brokers or dealers or specific auditors. The release also explains that firm-specific reports on inspections of broker-dealer audits will be deferred until a permanent program is established. Inspection procedures performed on a firm as part of the interim program will instead be treated as a foundational portion of the first inspection of the firm's broker and dealer audit practice, which eventually would be completed and encompassed within a firm-specific inspection report following the establishment of the permanent program if the firm is included in the permanent program. Some commenters expressed concerns about including observations from the interim inspection program in a firm-specific inspection report that may be issued years later, after the permanent program is established, and after the relevant standards and rules, as well as the firm's practices, may have changed. Among other things, these commenters requested clarification on whether the eventual report would present cumulative findings on deficiencies observed. The release clarifies that the idea is not for the later reports to serve as historical records of all observations from interim program procedures, but observations from interim program procedures might retain their relevance to the board's inspection dialogue with a particular firm, even after standards and rules have changed. And it may be appropriate in some cases for aspects of those observations to be included in the first inspection report eventually issued to the firm. If that occurs, however, the report would make clear the timing of the original inspection observation at issue. Before leaving the subject of firm-specific reports, I do want to note that the rule does not absolutely exclude the possibility of them. Unusual circumstances could cause the board to discuss the results of a particular inspection under the interim program in a firm-specific report issued during the interim program. We're not expecting that to happen. We don't have in mind particular circumstances that would cause that to happen, but the possibility is not entirely excluded under the rule. For that reason, the temporary rule also incorporates provisions of the board's rules that relate to issuing inspection reports and evaluating a firm's efforts to remediate quality control criticisms in inspection reports. But as the release emphasizes, the inclusion of those rules is only a precaution and does not signal any expectation that firm-specific inspection reports will be issued during the interim program. If the Commission approves the rule, the Board would carry out inspection procedures under the temporary rule until a rule for a permanent program replaces it. The release notes that the board anticipates being in a position to propose rules for a permanent program in 2013. With that, my colleagues and I here would be happy to answer any questions you may have about the recommendation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Are there any motions regarding staff recommendation in the matter?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion. I move that the board adopt Rule 4020T and the related amendments to Rule 1001 as recommended by the staff. Instruct the staff to submit the rules to the Securities and Exchange Commission for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Gelzer and Mr. Harris. And thank you for that presentation. I want to acknowledge on behalf of the board the staff that helped bring this project to fruition, including in particular Michael Stevenson, Jennifer Williams from the General Counsel's Office, Bob Madej, Alan Kerwin from the Divisions of Registration and Inspections. We're grateful for the hard work that went into it. As the staff presentation makes clear, our action today is based on careful consideration of thoughtful comments received on the board's December 2010 proposal. The Dodd-Frank amendments, as Michael points out, do not prescribe a specific program of inspection. Rather, the Act authorizes this board to establish such a program by rule and leaves to the board important questions concerning the elements of the program. As the staff has described, the Dodd-Frank amendments allow the board to assign different inspection schedules to the auditors of different kinds of broker-dealers. They also provide that if the board exempts any accounting firm from our registered inspection program, the board would not be required to continue to be registered with the board. We take these provisions very seriously, as I know the board did when it proposed and sought comment on the rule we consider today. It is important to remember where the PCAOB's oversight fits in the overall framework of regulations already in place, and it's also important to reflect on the limits of the board's new authority under Dodd-Frank. Brokers and dealers are already subject to regulatory oversight. Both the SEC and FINRA have authority over the brokers and dealers who have direct contact with investors. The PCAOB does not. I think it was wise of the previous board to propose a program that would allow it promptly to begin inspection work to implement the statute, but equally important that the program allows us flexibility so we can concentrate our resources on areas where our work will provide meaningful investor protection. It's important also that we do this in a way that does not impose unnecessary burdens in any areas, especially on those where our oversight may not have a meaningful effect on fraud deterrence. The program is thus limited in time and scope. After gaining valuable insight through the interim inspection program, I anticipate we will then carefully consider whether there should be exemptions from the permanent program, including for auditors or brokers that bear the characteristics highlighted by commentators, such as those so-called introducing brokers who are not permitted to accept client funds. Fair arguments have been advanced that auditor oversight is not the most effective way to combat certain kinds of fraud perpetrated on investors by broker-dealers. During the legislative process, SIPC and the SEC's chief accountant put forward evidence that frauds by brokers do occur. But others ask whether PCAOB oversight of the broker's auditor would meaningfully deter that broker from perpetrating fraud. That's a question to which I don't pretend to know the answer today. Interim inspection procedures should help us get a better handle on it. Congress made, though, a deliberate decision not to exempt any classes of brokers and dealers or their auditors from board, not to exempt any class of broker-dealer auditors from board oversight. With the benefit of the results of our interim inspection program, which Congress did not have when it included all auditors of registered brokers and dealers within PCAOB oversight, we may be able to narrow the scope and cost of the law to focus on areas where our oversight would make a difference. To this end, the temporary program will look a lot different than the full inspection program will. The interim program, as Michael mentioned, will not include firm-specific inspection reports. Instead, to keep the public informed of our progress, we will periodically publish reports on the types of investor risk inspectors find. Importantly, though, if we find violations of law, we won't wait to act on them. We'll use our disciplinary authority in any appropriate cases of auditor misconduct, and we will refer information about potential broker-dealer misconduct to both the SEC and FINRA. Let me now turn to my fellow board members for any comments or discussion they may have. Mr. Gelzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make some comments of my own and then also ask the staff a couple questions. As we've already heard, Section 982 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act gave the board inspection, standard setting, and enforcement authority over auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. The temporary interim inspection rule the board is considering today is a major step down the road of turning this new authority into a functioning oversight program. While getting the interim inspections up and running is certainly important, many questions still need to be addressed. One of the most critical is whether or not the permanent inspection program should apply to all brokers and dealers. There are about 5,000 SEC-registered broker-dealers. However, only about 520 provide clearing and custody services. Many of the others are introducing firms that, at least in theory, don't have access to client funds and securities. Some, I think, are floor brokers without public clients. Some are insurance agents that sell products that are technically securities. Some are finders in the mergers and acquisition market. Some are captives that serve the trading needs of a single affiliated client, and I'm sure other categories also exist. This diversity in business models and risk profiles raises obvious questions about whether the board should devote resources to inspecting the auditors of all these types of brokers and dealers, or whether some can safely be excluded without compromising investor protection. In enacting Section 982, Congress heard arguments in favor of exempting some classes of audits, such as those of introducing firms, which don't seem to pose much risk to the general investing public. However, both the SEC and CPIC staffs recommended against exemptions, and the Act contains none. Instead, Section 982 turns the problem of differential oversight and exemptions over to the board. As Michael Stevenson has quoted, the statute directs the board to consider whether differing inspection cycles would be appropriate with respect to registered public accounting firms that issue audit reports only for brokers and dealers that don't receive, handle, or hold customer securities or cash, or that aren't members of CPIC. The law is silent on exactly how the board should make these decisions. If the board does decide that auditors of some types of broker-dealers need not be subject to any inspection schedule at all, those firms can withdraw from PCOB registration. Because of the lower risk of investor harm, I believe that the board will ultimately conclude that auditors of some classes of brokerage firms should be exempt from PCOB oversight. I also believe, however, that the best way to make that decision is on the basis of the type of factual information that can most effectively be collected during the interim inspection program. As we've heard, the temporary rule will allow the board to develop an empirical record on whether adopting differing inspection schedules or exemptions for some classes of firms would be appropriate. In fact, the primary focus of the interim inspections will be on gathering data to inform board consideration of how to structure the permanent program. Armed with this information, the board will be in a better position to determine the objectives, nature, and frequency of inspection for different classes of brokers and dealers, to decide on possible exemptions from oversight, and to defend those determinations and decisions if they're questioned. Some commenters have argued that broker-dealer audit costs are rising, and that this imposes burdens on smaller introducing firms that should be addressed immediately. I certainly don't minimize this concern, but I think it's important to recognize that the board itself has not yet taken any action at all to change the way that broker-dealer audits are conducted. Increases in audit effort and fees are likely the result of the attention that brokerage firm auditing has attracted in the wake of the Madoff Ponzi scheme and the criminal proceedings against Madoff's auditor. In any case, only a small number of firms whose audit work is limited to non-custodial introducing brokers are likely to be inspected during the interim program. The temporary rule provides for transparency concerning what the board is finding in interim inspections, and there will be ample opportunity for everyone affected to weigh in on whether some firms should be excluded from the permanent program. The board will issue public reports at least annually on the progress of the interim program and on any significant observations. The board will also eventually issue firm-specific reports, but those will not be finalized unless and until a firm has also had an inspection in the permanent program. So, in summary, I think the interim rule approach strikes the right balance between the board's obligation to develop the information necessary to design an inspection program that fulfills its investor protection responsibilities and the very legitimate concerns regarding the need to avoid imposing unnecessary costs on small brokerage firms and their auditors. And I do support the rule. And just to reiterate, this rule making has largely been the responsibility of the Office of the General Counsel, but of course by our General Counsel, Gordon Seymour. I particularly want to thank Deputy General Counsel Michael Stevenson and Assistant General Counsel Jennifer Williams for their work. The broker-dealer interim inspection program will be headed by Bob Madej, Associate Director in the Division of Registration and Inspections, which of course is led by Helen Munter. So I also want to acknowledge the work that they've put in on this project and thank them. Your work, however, is just beginning.
Yes.
Let me ask you about a couple of issues that have been touched on in the comments already. Certainly one of the things that we heard in the comments was that introducing firms or auditors for introducing firms shouldn't be part of the interim program because of the burdens that it would impose on them. I wonder if we could get a sense of what the scope of the interim program will be and how likely it is or how frequently it is that a firm that has only clients that are non-custodial introducing brokers is likely to see a PCOB inspector. I mean, I know it may be difficult to be too specific about that at this stage, but can you give kind of a ballpark sense?
Well, I think in terms of round numbers, it's not very likely that any individual auditor will see us. We intend in the course of the interim program to look at less than 100 individual audits, and we'll split our time, focusing the bulk of our time on auditors of broker-dealers who have custodial accounts. About 75% of our time will be there. 25% of our time will be looking at a number of audits of broker-dealers without customer accounts. I think, though, it is very important for us to spend the time to look at those audits in order to understand what is the work that is being done, how is it approached, what controls is the auditor identifying, testing, and relying upon in doing his work.
I mean, I certainly agree with you that I think it's important that we do look at the audits of some non-custodial introducing firms, but I would hope that people would take some comfort from the fact that if you're an auditing firm that has your clientele is solely in that area, it's probably not that likely that you're going to see a PCOB inspector during the course of the next year.
Yeah, I think for the percentage of the broker-dealers whose audits will be inspected is about 1.5%. And of the firms that audit broker-dealers, the percentage that we might expect to inspect in this interim program is about 5.5%. So it's very small numbers for the total population.
Let me ask you a different kind of question about the scope of the program. I assume that there are a significant number of registered firms that were already inspecting because they have issuer clients that also have non-public broker-dealer clients. How will the interim program work for them? Will there be some coordination between the two kinds of inspections?
Our goal would certainly be to have a coordinated approach such that we would be able to accomplish the work of looking at the broker-dealer audit at the same time as we're looking at the other work. However, I'm sure that there will be some poor broker-dealer auditor out there who might be inspected more than once under both programs. But our goal would be to have a coordinated and logical approach to getting this work done.
Let me ask you a little about what you're going to be inspecting for. And again, I think Michael touched on this in his comments, but as I understand the situation currently, we, of course, have standard-setting authority over broker-dealer audits, but we haven't exercised it yet, and the SEC is considering amending its Rule 17A5 that describes what reports auditors have to have association with. So against that background, the SEC has said that for the time being, broker-dealer auditors should continue to apply GAS, as they have traditionally, that is the AICPA's auditing standards. And again, as I understand it, if you're into this area, an important document is the broker-dealer audit guide that the AICPA has long promulgated, which is not itself an auditing standard. It's an interpretive publication, although I think the auditing standards would say that an auditor that doesn't follow applicable interpretive guidance should be prepared to explain why they didn't follow it. Again, that would be the broker-dealer guide in this case. I think Michael said in his comments that in our inspections we would take appropriately into account, might have been the phrase, the audit guide. I know lawyers love the word appropriate because it can cover such a lot of ground. I mean, can you give me a sense of what we're going to be looking for in these inspections? Are we going to be expecting compliance with the broker-dealer audit guide? If the guide wasn't followed, are we going to be expected to see in the work papers an explanation of why it wasn't? Is that simply something we'd expect an auditor to explain to us? It seems like we're going to be operating kind of a murky area here in the first year or two of the inspections.
Well, I think those questions are part of what we want to accomplish with the interim inspection program, and that is to see the nature of the testing performed, see the extent of that testing, look at it in relation to the guidance that the firms have available, look at it in relation to whatever methodologies the firms have, and allow us to assess that and get an understanding of what they're doing and the extent of their testing.
I think in particular in the area of the audits of broker-dealers without custodial accounts, we'll want to understand what controls did the auditor identify and test with respect to that assertion that the broker-dealer does not have custodial accounts.
I mean, it sounds as if this may be a difficult area to identify audit deficiencies or matters that rise to the level of referral to our enforcement division, except in fairly flagrant cases.
And it's an area where we do not have experience, so I think it'll be very important to gain that experience in order to inform a recommendation.
Will some of the basics of our standards apply? For example, AS3, our documentation requirement, will that be applicable? I guess it won't, at least at the commencement.
No, not currently, no. I mean, at some point, PCOB standards are made applicable to audits of brokers and dealers, then they will. But AS3, audit documentation, AS7, engagement quality review, a couple examples that come to mind, don't at the present time apply to audits of brokers and dealers. The generally accepted auditing standards are still what apply pursuant to Commission Rule 17A5.
Which do, of course, contain a documentation requirement.
Well, right, but a different one from AS3. Right.
You touched a little on the reporting situation. You might just elaborate a little on that. I think the release describes these inspections as foundational with respect to any firm-specific report that might ultimately be adopted, but I take it that the thrust here is that these inspections are not really so much aimed at identifying deficiencies that will later be identified in firm-specific reports and have to be remediated as they are in gathering information for us to inform the permanent program.
That's right. I mean, if deficiencies are identified, I think there'd be the usual inspection effort, short of an inspection report, to focus the firm on the deficiency and focus the firm on doing what's necessary to address it and prevent it from happening again. But by the time a permanent program is established, that firm is inspected again, or the inspection is completed, if you will, a lot of time may have passed. And I think a judgment will have to be made at that point about whether that original, that observation during the interim program remains relevant in some way, appears to have ongoing relevance to concerns about the firm's practice. And if so, that may be a reason to include it in the report that's eventually issued, and to include it as incorporated into quality control concerns that are then expected to be addressed through the formal process.
I mean, I just raise it because it's something that bothered firms that commented a lot. That is, the concept that the inspection report might not be issued until many years, several years after the inspection, and that they would then be held accountable for deficiencies that might not really be relevant to their practice any longer, or might not apply under the new standards or something like that. And I think that's the way we've set this up. I think that's sort of a misplaced concern.
That's not the case, and we tried to clarify that in the release to allay those concerns.
Let me end by just asking about two other kinds of things. And we've brought about 520 new firms into our system here as a result of the requirement that broker-dealer auditors register. And, of course, we have many existing firms that are also broker-dealer auditors. What are we going to be doing to educate these firms about the PCAOB and what's expected of them? I mean, obviously, we have this very successful small business firm outreach program. What about something for broker-dealers? Which brings us to Mary Soquist, who's in charge of that area.
Is this one on?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, we will be holding our first two forums for auditors of smaller broker-dealers in 2011 this year. And the first of those is going to be in Jersey City, New Jersey, on October 28th. The second will be on the West Coast in Huntington Beach, California, on November 17th. The links to both of these will be on our website today so that participants can begin to register for these forums. And we're certainly encouraging auditors and broker-dealers to attend these forums. We're working on the final agenda right now. I mean, not the agenda, really, but more the contents. I think we know what our agenda will be. But generally, the forums will provide an overview of what PCAOB oversight means to auditors who have broker and dealer clients. The primary focus will be on the inspection process and also auditing standards that apply to the audits of broker-dealers. We'll have some discussion of the PCAOB disciplinary process. The forums are going to also provide an overview of the funding rule that is the next item on the board's agenda. And finally, we expect to post additional details this week about these forums.
Thanks, Mary. I think this is something very important because a lot of these firms don't really know much about the PCAOB or what to expect. I think we're hearing at the existing small business forums that there's curiosity about how the board's work will affect broker-dealer auditors. Finally, just one question in a somewhat different area, but I think it's one that we hear a lot about through inquiries and so on. The SEC has an investment advisor rule, Rule 2642, which basically says that certain auditors of investment advisors have to be registered with the board and inspected by the board. Auditors of advisors that are deemed to have custody of client securities. As the situation stands, at least up until today, that means that those auditors have to have a public company, an issuer as a client, because we don't have any authority to inspect investment advisor audits, so the only way you can get to be PCAOB inspected is to have an issuer client. Will this rule change that? In other words, now all broker-dealer auditors are at least theoretically subject to PCAOB inspection, so will this meet their subject to inspection requirement for purposes of Rule 2642?
The operative phrase in Rule 20642 is subject to regular inspection.
Regular.
And that's not been a hard question with respect to auditors of issuers who, under our Rule 4003, are subject to regular inspection. That's the words in Rule 4003. The Rule 4020T doesn't use the word subject to regular inspection. Neither the rule nor our release attempt to answer the question you're asking. It's ultimately a question for the Commission whether the fact of a firm's inclusion within the scope of the interim program constitutes being subject to regular inspection for purposes of their rule.
I meant to bring along with me the phone number for the Chief Counsel's Office of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC, but I neglected to. I mean, basically, that's where that question would have to be directed. I assume it's beyond our ability to answer.
It's beyond mine.
Thank you very much.
Board Member Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the rule before us today for an interim program of inspections of broker-dealer audits for the reasons I indicated in my remarks when we considered the subject of the proposed rule during our open meeting on December 14, 2010. And I would ask that my earlier statement be included at the end of my remarks today. As you and others have pointed out, this interim inspection approach will allow the board to begin its inspections of firms that audit brokers and dealers and will inform the board's decision with respect to the scope of a permanent program. As I said last December, and as others have said this morning, one of the critical questions facing the board is whether it is in the best interest of investors for the board to provide introducing broker dealers with an exemption from inspection and regulation by the PCAOB. This interim inspection program by no means prejudges that issue. Rather, it affords the board, as others have stated, the opportunity to thoroughly analyze the issue of possible exemptions, as I believe is required by the legislative history, which I discussed more fully in my statement in December. In the context of our interim inspection program and future approach, I plan to remain mindful of all concerns that have been expressed to the board, including those of the SEC, our plenary authority, CIPIC, as well as members of Congress who have written us on the issue, namely House Financial Services Committee Chairman Spencer Baucus and Subcommittee Chairman on Capital Markets and Government-Sponsored Enterprise Chairman Scott Garrett, as well as 8 CPA members of the House. I join you, Mr. Chairman, and others in thanking the staff for their efforts and absolutely thorough analysis in developing the rule before us today. And I just have a couple of questions. In a comment letter to the board from the Third Party Marketers Association, they indicated that their members have suffered the burden of increased fees for annual audits. In some cases, most predominantly in more rural areas, costs have skyrocketed. And that's a quote. If the board's release states that the standards that apply to audits of brokers and dealers have not changed from what they were before the Dodd-Frank amendments, I was wondering if you can explain this apparent disconnect. And why would audit fees for smaller broker-dealers skyrocket before the PCAOB has exercised any of its new oversight authority?
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that right now. I mean, as Dan mentioned, there's been a lot of attention given to broker-dealer auditing in the wake of Madoff, and the SEC late last year reminded firms of the obligation to conduct audits in accordance with GAS under Rule 17A5. Whether those things have contributed to increases in cost, I'm not in a position to say. But as Dan also mentioned, certainly nothing that the PCAOB has done yet had any effect other than, for some firms, I suppose, being required to register.
And then how do we plan to select the firms to inspect?
And our goal of selecting firms to inspect will be to see a wide variety of types of firms, types of broker-dealer audits, in order to inform our decision-making for the final. So it will not be a risk-based selection process that we go through. When we're inspecting the auditors of issuers, it will be meant to give us just a wide variety of information to inform a final program.
And the 10 members of Congress that we heard from, there were 2 letters, but one letter was signed by 2, the other letter was signed by 8, have expressed concerns about the cost of the program. And I'm wondering, how does the staff envision weighing the benefits to investors of these inspections of broker-dealer audits against the potential costs and burdens to smaller firms?
I mean, that's carefully, I guess, is how I would answer the question. I mean, you know, I think the details remain to be seen. I mean, it depends a little bit on what inspections finds, and then we'll just have to put that all together and think very carefully about concerns people have raised, fair concerns about whether additional protection to investors that would come from inspecting some of these categories of auditors really justify whatever burdens might be, regulatory burdens and costs might be imposed.
So. And will that analysis be in the annual reports that you're going to be giving us? What's going to be included in the annual report?
I would expect that the annual reports will report on the progress. I think probably you can expect to see some quantitative information. Any significant observations that we find, and from the perspective of, I think, focusing on what the end goal is here, that at the end of this process, the board wants to propose a rule and propose either excluding some categories of firms or not excluding any categories of firms, but either way, having a basis and a rationale for why that is. I think that the reports along the way will be framed around that end result, but I guess I wouldn't anticipate the annual reports to really dive into and provide an analysis the way that I would expect the proposing a rule proposal for a permanent program to do.
I know the answer to this question, but in order to get it on the record, the release indicates that it may not be before 2013 that the board is able to propose rules for a permanent program. The question is, why is it taking us so long?
I guess from one perspective that seems long, from another perspective maybe it's not so long. I think we want to keep in mind that one of the things that's going to be happening between now and then is the rules and standards applicable to those audits are likely to change. So we can, inspection staff can go out in 2011 and be looking at audits performed under the old standards and old rules, or the currently applicable standards and rules. I think among other things, it would be useful for the interim program to be in place and before the board proposes a permanent program to have looked at to know what those changes are and to actually have looked at some audits that are performed in accordance with under the new rules and standards. So I think that's probably the biggest piece of it.
Well, I totally understand it in this case. In other cases, I'm somewhat impatient in terms of how long it takes us to get standards out, but in terms of the thorough analysis that I think is extremely important in this instance, I appreciate the thoroughness to which you're approaching this. And you touched on it before, but what enforcement action could be taken in the interim by the PCAOB for a poor inspection finding?
The board could take enforcement action against an auditor if the audit currently, in the current situation, before any change in rules or standards. If an auditor fails to conduct the audit in accordance with GAS, that would be a violation of Rule 17A5, the Commission's rule, and the board has a disciplinary authority against auditors or over auditors for violations of those rules.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for an excellent job.
Board Member Ferguson.
I also support adopting this temporary rule and the prompt commencement of an interim inspection program. I believe that we're taking a very thoughtful approach by starting with this interim inspection program, although I do hope and would urge us to do this expeditiously and to try to get a permanent program in place as quickly as possible. As Michael Stevenson noted, the interim inspection program will allow the board to assess registered public accounting firms' current compliance with laws, rules, and standards as they perform audits of brokers and dealers. It will also inform our ultimate decisions about the significant elements of a permanent inspection program, including whether to differentiate among classes of brokers and dealers and whether to exempt any categories of public accounting firms and what minimum inspection frequency schedules to establish. I'd also note that the board has had experience with interim or limited inspection operations in its past. For example, when the board began operations in 2003, the board conducted limited inspections of the Big Four accounting firms. And those limited inspections provided invaluable information to the board as we commenced to determine how to set up a permanent inspection program for registered public accounting firms that audit public companies. And we plan to take a very careful and informed approach to establishing a permanent program that appropriately protects the public interest and the interest of investors, and we intend to look carefully at the potential costs and regulatory burdens that would be imposed on different categories of registered public firms and classes of brokers and dealers. I also note and am heartened by the fact that as we proceed with this process, we will be issuing periodic reports that will inform the public of what we're finding and what we find to be important in these matters. Many of the commenters on the proposal were concerned about the inclusive scope of the interim program. And I'd like to note that this inclusive scope should not be construed as either foreshadowing the likely scope of a permanent program or suggesting that every broker or dealer auditor will be inspected as part of the interim program. My expectation is that we will be able to gather the necessary information to inform our consideration of a permanent inspection program without having to inspect most firms during the interim program. I also believe that my fellow board members and I will carefully consider whether there should be exemptions from the permanent program. And I, for one, expect that we will, in fact, craft a more limited permanent program. Finally, I'd like to thank those in the organization, or thank those organizations and individuals who took time to comment on the board's proposal. The insightful comments were, as always, of great assistance to the board in finalizing the temporary rules. And I'd also like to thank the members of the General Counsel staff and the Division of Inspections who did such terrific work on this. I'd simply like to ask one question. As we go forward here in gathering this information, will we be individually gathering information on the costs that our inspection process imposes on people? Or will we simply rely on the people themselves to come forward and saying it's cost us this much? I mean, we've heard clearly from members of Congress, we've heard from individual brokers and dealers that this is, that, you know, these inspections are likely to be enormously costly. Will we be trying to gather our own information on this so we will have an objective judgment about it?
I think my understanding is that there is consideration being given, there's an effort underway to analyze whether broker-dealer audit costs are increasing and how to assess what the factors are that may be responsible for that, including to what extent costs are incurred by having to cooperate with PCOB inspections. Data relevant to that might be picked up through inspections, but I don't know that the inspection work would be the sole source of that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Board Member Hanson.
One of the benefits of going last is I have nothing new to say, but nonetheless, I will say it anyway. I'd like to join my fellow board members in thanking the staff for their thoughtful efforts in developing the recommendations today. The rules we're adopting today will enable the board to commence in a timely fashion its oversight of the auditors of brokers and dealers. At the same time, the interim inspection program will allow time for new rules and standards related to broker-dealer audits to evolve and the board to consider an appropriate scope and approach for permanent broker-dealer oversight. Moreover, the rules will close the gap that remained after the requirement for broker-dealers to register with us but not be inspected, which none of us could really rationalize how that made any sense. I also support the recommended approach in providing transparency over the board's interim oversight activities by issuing annual summary reports rather than publishing the individual firm inspection reports. This approach strikes an appropriate balance. It gives investors and the public insight into the board's activities and observations during the interim inspection program while allowing the board and the auditors of broker-dealers to focus during this transition period on adapting to a changing framework rather than the nuances of drafting and responding to public inspection reports. Related to the introducing broker-dealers, which we've talked a lot today about, several of the comments received by the board address the question of whether or not the board's interim inspection program should include inspections of auditors of introducing brokers and dealers that do not maintain customer cash and securities. Commenters who oppose the inclusion of introducing broker-dealers in the board's interim inspection program argued that the risk to the investors presented by introducing broker-dealers is low, while the regulatory burden stemming from the PCAOB inspections of these auditors is high. Supporters of the rule considered today believe the risks are substantial enough to justify PCAOB oversight over the auditors of broker-dealers. Similar arguments were made when Congress considered the scope of the broker-dealer oversight provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act. Congress ultimately decided to give the board the responsibility of determining the appropriate scope for its broker-dealer audit inspection program. While the risk presented to investors by the activities of introducing broker-dealers may be lower than those presented by carrying or clearing brokers, risks do exist. Auditors have a role to play in providing assurances that those risks are minimized, including confirming that these brokers and dealers are not exceeding the scope of permissible activities. In order for the board to appropriately balance the risks presented by introducing broker-dealers against the effectiveness and costs of PCAOB oversight, the board must gain a full understanding of the role played by the auditors of all broker-dealers in addressing the potential risks to investors. I agree that the best way for the board to gather the relevant information is to inspect for a time the auditors of all classes of brokers and dealers. Nevertheless, I wish to emphasize, as others have today, that the board is mindful of the concerns expressed about the potential regulatory burden associated with PCAOB oversight. We have not made any judgments about the appropriate scope of a permanent inspection program. The board intends to include in the interim inspection program a sufficient number and variety of firms to permit the board to gather the necessary information while avoiding unreasonable costs for brokers and dealers and their auditors and ultimately investors. We will also continue to consult with the SEC, FINRA, and others who share the board's investor protection mandate in order to consider the role of auditor regulation against the backdrop of direct regulation over brokers and dealers. So I just have two questions that I don't think have been covered today, and I'll really address this one to Helen and Bob, and that's, you mentioned the how we're going to select and the overall scope, but for the smaller broker dealers that have not previously been subject to our oversight, that some of them might be so small they might not even have offices or office space for us to send a team in. So what types of things do we do to accommodate those smaller broker dealers, and what are the ways we conduct those inspections?
Our inspections are always scaled to the size and scope of what it is that we are looking at. And we would expect that the interim program would include a certain number of PCOB-based inspections, as we do with small auditors of issuers.
So wait, PCAOB-based. Aren't all inspections PCOB-based? What does that mean?
Well, in a PCOB-based inspection, we do not travel to the offices of the audit firm. The audit firm would send us the relevant work, and we would look at it in our offices and have phone conversations or video conferences with the audit firm in question. We found that to be very effective in doing inspections of issuers in certain instances, and would think it could work well for certain of these firms. For others of these firms, we would plan to travel to their offices and meet with them in person in order to understand, up close and personal, I guess, the way they approach their audits and their quality control systems.
And for any given smaller auditor or smaller broker-dealer, does this process take like days or weeks or months?
I think it's days. It's certainly not months. I can't imagine it being weeks. It could be a week or several days that we would spend in their offices. And where we were doing it PCOB-based, then we would, schedule phone calls and conferences at a convenient time, and that would probably wind up taking parts of a couple of days.
Okay. We've mentioned several times or discussed the enforcement activities and the findings, and how will a broker-dealer auditor know that we just something that maybe doesn't rise to a level of an enforcement action, but know when we have seen something that we don't think they did it right.
To the extent that we have that we identify deficiencies or concerns with their work, we would either communicate those orally if they're less significant, or communicate those using a comment form, which is a tool we use in doing the inspections of issuers. The firm would then have the opportunity to respond to our comment. And given that we would not be issuing firm-specific reports under this program, we would plan to communicate back to the firm, likely orally, our conclusions with respect to their response to the comment form, whether we found it persuasive or not persuasive and why.
And if we saw something that after this going back and forth, we said, gee, we really think you should have done more work or done something different, we would tell them that and expect them to do something about it?
Certainly. We would tell it to them, but we would probably not see them again until such time as they came up for inspection under a permanent program, if that were the case for their class of audits.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Chairman?
Well, first, I would like from the chair to thank the board, as the comments and the questions illustrate. My colleagues have devoted a lot of thought, careful thought, to the details and implications of this interim rule. I always come to these meetings, and whenever I meet with this board, I always learn things and find the conversation stimulating. To turn to something that Dan Gelzer mentioned, we do have, we're told, a number of investment advisor auditors who want to be able to represent, to audit investment advisors, and are seeking to satisfy the requirement that they be subject to PCAOB inspections. I take it, therefore, one of the interesting things that will come out of this is whether, in fact, auditors who would otherwise be entitled to any exemption that we might create in some cases may decide they want to remain subject to PCAOB registration and inspection and not assert the exemption in order to audit registered investment advisors. Kind of an interesting aspect of this, but happily not our decision, something we'll learn. If there's no further discussion, I'm going to put the question to the board. Would those in favor of approving the motion to adopt the rule on the interim inspection program for broker-dealers, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion is carried. Thanks again to the staff. We will turn now to what I think is the more straightforward part of this, which is the second item of the agenda, and that's the recommendation that the board adopt amendments to its funding rule.
Thank you again, Chairman Doty. And while the staff change seats, let me just say that on behalf of the Office of General Counsel, I'm also pleased to recommend today that the board adopt amendments to its funding rules. Since its inception, the board's primary source of revenue has been what the Sarbanes-Oxley Act calls the board's accounting support fee. As required by the Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among public companies and investment companies based on their relative equity market capitalizations. As we've been discussing today, the Dodd-Frank Act assigned the board the additional responsibility to oversee the audits of brokers and dealers. To pay for that oversight, Dodd-Frank directs the board to allocate its accounting support fee among not only public companies and investment companies, but also among broker-dealers. The rules we're recommending today would implement these provisions of Dodd-Frank by providing for a portion of the board's accounting support fee to be allocated to brokers and dealers. We're also recommending today that the board make certain changes to its existing rules related to the part of the accounting support fee that will continue to be assessed to public companies and investment companies. These changes are based on 8 years now of experience administering the funding rules and the funding process and are designed to make that process both more efficient and cost-effective for all concerned. Nina Majuri-Azad and Annie Braswell, accounting manager in the Office of Finance, will present the staff's recommendation. Before I turn the floor over to Nina and Annie, though, I'd like to acknowledge the work of both Annie and Nina, who I should say is Assistant General Counsel in the Office of General Counsel, as well as the work of Bob Burns, Associate General Counsel, on this rulemaking. And with that, let me turn it over to Nina to present the staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Gordon. Chairman Doty and members of the board, we are here today to recommend that the board adopt amendments to its funding rules to provide for a portion of the accounting support fee to be allocated among brokers and dealers. The rules we recommend today would only result in a fee being assessed to those brokers and dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital of greater than $5 million. We are also recommending that the board adopt amendments with respect to the allocation of the accounting support fee among issuers and related amendments to its Rule 1001. The funding rules adopted today would apply to the allocation of the 2011 broker-dealer accounting support fee, which we anticipate will take place in the fall of this year. The amendments related to issuers would take effect for the allocation of the 2012 issuer accounting support fee. The board received 8 comment letters on the proposed amendments to the rules. Commenters generally supported the amendments. Therefore, the rules before the board today are substantially similar to those proposed on December 14, 2010. The board proposed amendments to its funding rules in response to the Dodd-Frank Act, which amended Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to require for the equitable allocation, assessment, and collection by the board of its accounting support fee among issuers and brokers and dealers. Starting with the board's 2011 budget, the total accounting support fee is divided into a broker-dealer accounting support fee and an issuer accounting support fee. I will now highlight how the broker-dealer accounting support fee will be allocated among brokers and dealers pursuant to the funding rules before the board today. First, explaining the basis for the allocation. Second, discussing the differentiation among classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes. And third, describing the assessment and collection process applicable to the fee. The funding rules before the board today are consistent with the requirements in the Dodd-Frank Act that broker-dealer accounting support fee be allocated among brokers and dealers or classes of brokers and dealers based on their relative net capital before or after any adjustments, compared to the total net capital of all brokers and dealers before or after any adjustments. The reference to adjustments in relation to the net capital permits the board to allocate the fee based on tentative net capital, which is net capital before deducting certain securities haircuts and changes in inventory used in calculating the net capital of a broker or dealer. Because the investment decisions made by a broker or dealer can influence the amount of these deductions and thus influence the net capital calculation, tentative net capital may be a more consistent and equitable basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee than net capital. Accordingly, the basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee under the rules will be the broker or dealer's tentative net capital. The rules, if adopted, would create 2 classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes based on whether the broker or dealer files financial statements with the commission, and if it does, on the amount of the broker's or dealer's tentative net capital. By differentiating brokers and dealers by class, which is allowed under the Dodd-Frank Act, the board is able to allocate the broker-dealer accounting support fee to those brokers and dealers whose audits, due to their relative size and complexity, may require more board time and resources during an inspection than other audits of brokers and dealers with relatively small and less complex operations. Brokers and dealers who are required to file audited financial statements and have average quarterly tentative net capital greater than $5 million will fall under Class 1. Those brokers will be assessed a proportionate share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee. All other broker-dealers will fall under Class 2 and will be assessed of the fee equal to zero, which basically means they will not receive an invoice and they will not pay any fee. Based on data received from FINRA, the vast majority of tentative net capital within the broker-dealer industry is concentrated in a relatively few brokers and dealers, with thousands of smaller broker-dealers having less than $5 million in tentative net capital. As a result, the staff anticipates that approximately 14% of the broker-dealer's population, or approximately 640 brokers and dealers, will fall in Class 1 and be assessed a share of the fee using the $5 million threshold. Following the allocation of the fee, the assessment and allocation process applicable to the fee will be similar to the process currently in place for issuers. For example, if a share of a broker-dealer accounting support fee allocated to a broker is past due and the broker has not filed a petition with the board seeking correction of its assigned share, Then, with certain exceptions, no registered public accounting firm is permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to the broker's financial statement or to sign a consent to the use of prior audit opinions for the broker. In addition, similar to issuers, brokers and dealers would be assessed monthly finance charges at a rate of 6% per year if they have an outstanding balance after 60 days of the date of their invoice. If the broker or dealer has an outstanding balance after the 90th day of the original invoice date, then the board may report the nonpayment to the commission or the broker's or dealer's designated examining authority. In addition to the funding rules related to brokers and dealers discussed above, we are recommending that the board adopt certain amendments to its existing rules for the allocation, assessment, and collection of the issuer accounting support fee. As you know, the board has conducted its funding under these rules since 2003. While the rules generally have functioned as intended, we believe that the allocation and assessment process could be more efficient in some respects. Annie will discuss most of the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules with respect to issuers. However, I would like to highlight one change for your attention. As required under Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among issuers based on their relative average monthly market capitalization. Under the board's current rules, an issuer's market capitalization is based on the aggregate market value of all classes of the issuer's common stock that trade in the United States. To reduce any interpretive issues as to whether certain types of securities not identified as common stock, such as limited partnership interests, should be included in an issuer's market capitalization, we recommend that the board amend the definition of issuer market capitalization and market capitalization of an issuer by replacing the reference to common stock with a reference to voting and non-voting common equity. Therefore, beginning in 2012, an issuer's market capitalization will be based on the issuer's aggregate market value of all classes of voting and non-voting common equity traded in the United States. The definition of common equity in the rules would track the definition of Rule 12b-2 under the Exchange Act, which includes any class of common stock or an equivalent interest, including but not limited to a unit of beneficial interest in a trust or a limited partnership interest, and any other security that the Commission, by rule, deems to treat as common equity. Preferred stock, warrants, and options would continue to be excluded when calculating an issuer's market capitalization for funding purposes. We do not believe this change will have a significant impact on the allocation of the fee for issuers. I would now like to turn it over to Annie, who will describe other amendments to the board's funding rules concerning issuers.
Thank you, Nina. In addition to the modification of the definition of issuer market capitalization, the amendments before the board propose an increase in market cap thresholds for issuer classes 1 and 2. Issuers in these classes are allocated portions of the issuer accounting support fee based on their relative average monthly market capitalizations. The amendments before the board would increase the market cap thresholds from $25 million to $75 million for Class 1 issuers, which includes public companies, and from $250 million to $500 million for Class 2 issuers, which includes investment companies. Under these revised thresholds, it is anticipated that approximately 1,100 less equity companies and approximately 1,450 less investment companies would be invoiced for a portion of the accounting support fee. We believe the increase in these thresholds allows for a more efficient funding process and reduces the administrative burden on smaller issuers with minimal effect on the fee assessments for other issuers. Additionally, we are proposing amendments to the consideration of issuers that are in bankruptcy and meet the modified reporting requirements of SEC Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2. These issuers are not required to file audited financial statements with the Commission, fall under the third class of issuers, and are allocated a portion of the accounting support fee equal to zero. In a number of instances, companies in bankruptcy who file modified reports will notify PCAOB staff that they meet the conditions for modified reporting under Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2. And should be allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. It is difficult, however, for PCAOB staff to verify such assertions since there is no requirement that an issuer receive no action relief from the SET's Division of Corporation Finance prior to filing modified reports. To avoid PCAOB staff having to determine whether or not a bankrupt issuer meets the conditions set forth in Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2, the amendments before the Board today would clarify that an issuer in bankruptcy that asserts that it meets the modified reporting requirements must provide an opinion of counsel that the issuer met those requirements as of the date that the accounting support fee was calculated. Further, the amendments would extend the time frame within which an issuer, broker, or dealer may petition the Board for correction of the class in which it has been placed or its allocated share of the accounting support fee. In the past, the funding rules permitted petitions for correction to be received within 30 days of the invoice date. However, staff has found over the past funding cycles that issuers rarely deliver petitions to the Board within 30 days, and the staff has typically accepted and considered petitions past that date. The amendments extend the time frame in which issuers, brokers, or dealers may file a petition from 30 days to 60 days and would allow acceptance of petitions for correction past 60 days when good cause is shown. Finally, with regard to a registered accounting firm ascertaining that an issuer, broker, or dealer client has paid its share of the accounting support fee, the proposed amendments clarify that it is not mandatory that a registered accounting firm obtain confirmation from the Board that prior to signing an unqualified audit opinion, consenting to include an audit report issued previously, or signing a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls of its issuer, broker, or dealer client. Rather, the firm may ascertain that its client has paid through various other means. As such, the amendments replace the word confirmation with the word determination in the caption for Rule 7104B and remove specific reference to obtaining confirmation from the Board. This modification is in recognition that confirmation is one of a number of procedures available to a registered public accounting firm when determining whether its client has an outstanding past due share of the accounting support fee. Under the Dodd-Frank amendments to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the PCAOB is required to begin allocation, assessment, and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund the first full fiscal year after the date the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted, which is the 2011 calendar year. As such, we expect that subject to approval of the funding rules by the SEC, the funding rules would be effective for the 2011 funding cycle for brokers and dealers and for the 2012 funding cycle for issuers. We are recommending that the Board approve the funding rules and related amendments to Rule 1001 before you today and are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Majuri-Assad, Ms. Brassmull. Any motions on this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Mr. Hanson.
I move that the Board adopt the amendments to the Board's funding rules and related amendments to Rule 1001 as recommended by the staff and instruct the staff to submit the amendments to the Securities and Exchange Commission for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. First, I want to acknowledge again the hard work of the staff who brought this project to fruition, including in particular Bob Burns, Nina Majuri-Assad, and Annie Braswell. We appreciate this work. I want to follow the good example of my colleague, Mr. Harris, and ask that my statement be included in the record and merely note two points that the staff has made. One is that we will be allocating zero and not billing our broker dealer with less than $5 million of tentative net capital, and that's going to eliminate a burden for almost all of the small brokers and dealers. And then, not to be overlooked, for issuers other than investment companies, there are 1,100 small issuers who will no longer be receiving any bill at all from us for any part of our support fee as a result of increasing the threshold. With that discussion, I want to turn to my fellow board members for discussion. Mr. Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I will make a brief statement and then also ask some questions. The funding rules create a framework for obtaining the resources to support the board's new responsibilities to oversee the auditors of securities brokers and dealers. The rules, as we've heard, will also raise the threshold so that public companies with market capitalizations below $75 million will no longer pay PCAOB support fees. In both cases, the result is that the largest companies and brokerages, that is, those whose financial reporting has the greatest potential impact on the investing public, will bear the lion's share of the board's costs. When Congress created the PCAOB in 2002, it charged the board with oversight of all U.S. public companies and provided that the board's work should be funded by those public companies. Last summer, in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress expanded the board's responsibilities, as we've already discussed, to include securities broker-dealers and extended the self-funding approach to require that broker-dealers pay those costs in proportion to their net capital. Broker-dealer net capital is highly concentrated. Of the 4,600 or so firms that are FINRA members, or for which FINRA is the examining authority or the financial review authority, just 1% of 33 firms, actually less than 1%, hold 80% of all the tentative net capital. The great majority of the firms are very small, and in fact, under any allocation methodology that we might come up with, thousands of firms would pay no support fee at all, simply because we round bills to the nearest $100, and many would round to zero under really any feasible allocation methodology. The new funding rules provide that only broker-dealers with tentative net capital in excess of $5 million will pay a share of the support fee. About 640 firms, around 14%, exceed that threshold. Last year, the board estimated that about 7% of its budget this year, that is around $14.5 million, would be devoted to broker-dealer oversight. So applying the new methodology to that budget number, the support fee assessment that will go to brokerage firms will range from a low of $400 to a high of a little over $1 million. About 100 firms will pay $500 or less, and only three will pay over $1 million. The board has the authority to exempt the auditors of classes of broker-dealers from board oversight. We've already discussed that at some length this morning. And we'll be making decisions about that as we gather more information through the interim inspection program. However, in my view, few, if any, of the larger broker-dealers that will be paying the support fee are likely to find that their auditors will ultimately be exempted from PCAOB oversight. The staff is also recommending changes to the rules related to public company support fees. Biggest practical effect of those changes will be the increase in the market capitalization threshold. Currently, all public companies with market capitalizations of at least $25 million must contribute to the board's funding of its issuer oversight program. That threshold will now raise to $75 million. The result, as Chairman Doty has said, is that about 1,100 issuers, that's about 23% of all the issuers that were assessed this year, will no longer be subject to the support fee. Granting that relief to those 1,100 companies only has a very small effect on those that are left paying the support fee, because the those that are going to be exempted were only paying about 0.4% of the total assessment to begin with. The rule revisions would also increase the market capitalization or net asset threshold from $250 million to $500 million for investment companies. That eliminates about 1,480 investment companies, roughly a third of all the investment companies that were assessed this year from the assessment program. The broker-dealer funding rules and the changes to the public company funding rules implement Congress's objective of requiring public companies and broker-dealers to provide the resources for the board's oversight of their auditors. I believe the rules will accomplish that goal without burdening smaller public companies, smaller broker-dealers, and smaller investment companies, and I certainly support the funding rule changes. These amendments were a joint effort, as we've heard, of the Office of the General Counsel and the Office of Finance. So I'd like to join the chairman in thanking Bob Burns and Nina Mojari-Assad from the General Counsel's Office for their work, and Annie Braswell, Manager of Accounting in the Finance Office, for her work on this project. Let me ask you just a couple of things about these rules. As I just mentioned, late last year, we estimated that we'd spend about $14.4 million this year on broker-dealer oversight. And so that's the number that will be used in cranking out the broker-dealer assessments this year. The year's half over. I guess we can't change that number, but do we still think that's a good estimate of what our costs will be this year?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, we're going to ask Phil Wiggins from the Budget Office to come on up.
The $14.4 million was based on a high-level allocation methodology, as you indicated, as part of last year's budget process. The majority of that amount related to headcount, primarily in inspections and related costs, travel, et cetera. Although we're halfway through the year, we don't have a better estimate at this time, and part of that relates to the timing of when we thought the staff would come on board this year. And the staff were the projected timing was weighted toward the second half of this year. So we're really starting to get into the time now where we'll be able to ascertain how accurate that number is or projection was.
Yeah, I appreciate the back-ending element. I mean, hopefully as we go forward with this program and other aspects of our operations evolve, we'll get better and better at making these estimates going forward. I guess we've all said now that we think about 640 brokerage firms will be assessed this year. Do we have any information about the demographics of those, what I'll call the demographics of those firms? For example, are any of them introducing firms with that don't have custody of client assets, or any of them don't have public clients because they're captives or something of that nature?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any specific demographics for those particular firms. We have been receiving data from FINRA, from other organizations of brokers and dealers, and so we do know that there are several, as you mentioned a while ago, that broker-dealers focus on particular types of business. Some just sell mutual funds, some just sell annuities, some are floor traders, some do a variety of different things. Some are mergers and acquisitions, some are just do private placements. There's a variety of business lines that are in. Not all of them are introducing, or not all of them are clearing and carrying. I think, though, from the data we received so far, though we can't isolate to particular firms at this point, I think that it's reasonable to assume that, as you were saying before, most of the 640, the larger ones, are going to be clearing and carrying, or the ones that are going to be involved somehow or another with dealing with customer funds or assets.
I just made the statement that I thought it was unlikely that the firms that were being assessed would find that their auditors would ultimately be exempted from PCOB oversight. I don't know whether you guys agree with that or not, but I guess maybe the point I would ask would is there isn't any connection between those two things, as you could have a situation where your auditor was not subject to PCOB oversight, but you, the broker, were still paying an assessment. Is that correct?
Well, if the board eventually decides, if I understand the question right, if the board eventually decides to exempt certain categories of brokers and dealer, or auditors of broker-dealers from an inspection program, and so they have the chance to deregister, do in fact deregister, and their broker-dealer audit clients would not really have to pay any fee. And the reason for that basically goes back to the definition of broker-dealer in Sarbanes-Oxley, because Sarbanes-Oxley takes the Exchange Act definition of broker-dealer and then adds to that the requirement that they actually have to have financial statements that are audited by a PCOB-registered auditor. So when you get down to actually the funding part of it, where you use the term broker, you're excluding those that don't have to hire a PCOB-registered broker. So that's kind of a long story. Maybe you didn't want the longest word. But the net effect is if you let them out of the inspection program, their clients are not going to have to pay the fee.
Well, I wish I'd asked you that question before the meeting. I might have to revise and extend my prior remarks to fix that point. I guess some I'll call them entities, have a different kind of issue, that you may have a public company, holding company, and then a broker-dealer subsidiary, or even multiple broker-dealer subsidiaries. So I take it that firms in that position, entities in that position could be paying two assessments, maybe even three or four assessments, depending upon their structure.
That's correct. An entity that the holding company falls under, the issuer, would be subject to the issuer accounting support fee, and any broker-dealer subsidiary below that parent would also be subject to the broker-dealer accounting support fee if they meet the thresholds that the board has established under the rules. In those situations, we believe that's appropriate because the inspection of the issuer audit is separate from the inspection of the broker-dealer work that we would be looking at.
Do we have any information about how many public companies have multiple broker-dealer affiliates?
Not currently, but we do anticipate that there are several large financial institutions that would fall under that category where they would have one or maybe multiple broker-dealer subsidiaries. And I'd like to just point out that when there are multiple broker-dealer subsidiaries under the issuer, each broker-dealer would be assessed a fee based on its own individual tentative net capital. We will not be accumulating those together.
Okay, well, let me turn to something a little different. I mean, I take it that the main way we enforce this rule, if I want to put it that way, is that Rule 7104 says that if the client hasn't paid its support fee, has a past due support fee, then the auditor can't sign an audit opinion with respect to that issuer. There is an exception to that provision. But how will that work in this world of sort of families of issuers and broker-dealers? In other words, if the issuer has paid the fee, can the issuer's auditor sign its audit report even if the broker-dealer subsidiaries haven't, and vice versa?
In a situation where you have a parent sub-relationship and the subsidiary broker-dealer has a past due outstanding fee, we would interpret that the rules the rules that are being proposed today would prohibit the auditor of the issuer parent from also signing an unqualified opinion if the broker-dealer subsidiary has a past due outstanding fee. So the impact of the outstanding past due broker-dealer, the broker subsidiary's fee would have an upstream effect. And it would only be an upstream effect, meaning that in a situation where the parent has not paid its issuer accounting support fee, it would not have effect on the auditor of the broker-dealer subsidiary.
Yeah, the idea is basically that if you have a broker-dealer that hasn't paid, the issuer may be able to help persuade the broker-dealer to come out and pay it, where that may not work in reverse. Yeah. So that's the basic philosophy.
And not to get too esoteric, but if a sister affiliate hasn't paid its fee?
We don't see that being a brother-sister relationship.
So that brings up the question of how the auditor is supposed to figure out if the fee was paid. And our rule has a note in it that says they can accept a representation or may ascertain that there's no support fee due based on a representation from the issuer. Commenters asked us to insert the word solely into that note so that it would say based solely on a representation from the issuer. But we declined to do that. So what does that mean, that the word solely isn't there?
We did not believe that the insertion of solely was appropriate, as we did not want to limit the procedures that the auditor may perform in ascertaining whether his or her client has an outstanding share of the accounting support fee. There are multiple procedures available to the auditor. One is to obtain a representation from his or her client. Others may include asking for a confirmation from the board or going on our website and looking at the list of entities without any shares of outstanding fee.
If I get a representation, conventional representation from management of the issuer, that the fee's been paid, do I have to do something else besides? Being aware of the fact that the board declined to insert the word solely into that note.
We've previously stated that a representation from your client is sufficient. However, if there's contradictory evidence that the auditor finds, they would have to, just as in any other case, investigate that information and determine what the ultimate resolution is.
Okay, so it's sort of a red flag test. In other words, I can't accept the representation if I have some red flag that it might not be.
That's right.
Specter case lives.
I guess that's right. You mentioned two other interesting things, the list and confirmation from the board. We put up a list now of issuers that have paid the support fee. Are we going to put up a list of brokers that have paid the support fee also?
Yes, we plan to put up a list of issuers or broker-dealers that have been assessed a portion of the broker-dealer accounting support fee and have paid in full, similar to the issuer list.
Because I guess if you look and your client isn't on the list, then you still have to figure out whether that means they haven't paid or whether they just simply weren't required to pay because there's so many exempt.
That's true. And at any time, they can reach out to us for confirmation.
Oh, good. I'm glad you mentioned that. Because the note, I believe the note currently says that obtaining confirmation from the board is one way to ascertain whether the support fee has been made. But we're deleting that from the note, are we not? What are people supposed to take away from that?
The point there is that confirmation or representation from the client is one way of getting or determining if a company has paid their accounting support fee assessment. But in addition, we do intend to proceed with providing confirmations upon request from issuers, brokers or dealers, or their auditors.
Why are we taking it out of that? I mean, if we're still going to do it and it's still a valid way of getting an answer to the question, what's the meaning of taking it out of the note?
The deletion was merely to indicate that confirmation was not the only means, but actually one of many. So we just didn't want auditors to think that by us using the word confirmation, that was the only way they could ascertain whether their clients have any outstanding fees.
One last thing. There, we mentioned that there's an exception to Rule 7104, which basically says that to make a regulatory filing or engage in a capital raising transaction on a one-time basis, the auditor can sign, notwithstanding that the issuer, or now the broker, hasn't paid the fee. But if I have this all straight, formerly the issuer had to give us notice that it happened. Now we're switching to the auditor having to give us notice that had happened. And people didn't like that in the comments. I mean, the auditors who commented, I think, felt that this should remain an issuer responsibility and the requirement shouldn't be transferred to them. And what's the thinking in making that change?
Right. The auditing firms generally did not think that was a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the reason that we're doing it basically is the fact that, to be perfectly honest, there have not been all that many notices filed over the years, and I think one of the reasons for that might be the fact that issuers just aren't that familiar with the rules, and they aren't accustomed to looking into the PCAOB rules for things that they need to do, and it's much easier for the auditor to be aware of the requirement, to know the implications of not filing it, and to make sure that the notice gets in on time and to the right people, and we'll be able to check that when we go out for inspections and see what's going on with the actual application of the rule.
Well, yeah, that's the charitable explanation. The nicer explanation might be that issuers have no fear of us since we can't do anything to them, so why should they comply with our rules? What will happen if an auditor doesn't file one of these notices? Would that potentially be an enforcement matter?
Well, the rule says that the auditor can only sign an unqualified opinion if they ascertain that the fee has been paid. So if the fee has not been paid and they sign an unqualified opinion, there's been a violation of a PCAOB rule, which would be subject to disciplinary action.
But couldn't there be a situation where the not signing was in compliance with the exception? So it was okay to sign.
Well, it's only okay to sign.
Should have been given to us, but wasn't.
Well, it's only okay to sign if you meet the conditions of the rule, and the notice coming in would be one of the conditions of the rule. So you don't qualify to get the exception unless you meet all the conditions.
So the signing would be a violation of our rules in that case, and at least theoretically subject to enforcement.
Yes.
Would the filing be invalid in some way, or the audit opinion?
That's something that the SEC would have to.
In the 34 Act?
That's something the SEC, I think, would have to decide as to whether or not they continue to accept the filing or whether or not they want to do anything with it.
We need the phone number for the Chief Counsel's Office of Corporation Finance. or maybe the chief account. Thank you very much.
Board Member Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support these funding rules and will put my comments in the record. Very briefly, I would like to emphasize in particular, as you have, Mr. Chairman, and Dan has, that these funding rules are considerate of the likely burden on small firms. You've clearly taken that into account, and I think that's extremely important. The rules also provide the same sort of relief for public companies and investment companies. Specifically, the market capitalization thresholds will be raised from what they were under the previous funding rules, and as a result, the number of companies that do not receive an invoice from the PCAOB will increase. In sum, I think the staff has done a terrific job on a very technical issue, which I appreciate. I just have one question, and that is, for the record, how did you decide on only two classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes?
When we were looking at, when we were coming before the board in December, we had looked at the broker-dealer data that we had received from FINRA and determined what would be the population of broker-dealers being assessed using no threshold or various other thresholds. And under the no threshold, as Dan mentioned, because of our rounding, a substantial number of the broker-dealer population would still not be assessed a fee. Comparing that to a $5 million threshold, it would appear that about 900 broker-dealers would not get assessed under the $5 million threshold, but that only represents 1% of the fee being redistributed to the 640. So we thought that's the analysis that we went through, and we assessed, proposed a $5 million threshold.
Thank you very much.
Board Member Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to put my records, my comments in the record and say that I support the adoption of this rule. I would also note that I think it's a testament to the staff's thoughtful analysis in dividing brokers into two classes that the commenters on this basically supported this allocation. And I think it's also shows pretty clearly that the board is very sensitive to imposing burdens on small firms. And I also support, appreciate very much the hard work and very thoughtful work that you all did in coming up with this. And I have two questions. One, when we are calculating these fees and looking at average quarterly tentative net capital, I assume we do that by looking at public filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Is that where we get that information?
We anticipate that we'll be getting the data from FINRA and the designated and other self-regulating organizations that the broker-dealers are registered with and file reports with. The information will be coming from focus reports, but that information is not public.
Okay. So this will be private information that's filed with their regulatory information.
Yes.
But they will be provided to us.
Yes.
The second question is, for issuers, where we've now changed the threshold for issuers for purposes of the allocating the accounting support fee, have you calculated to what extent for those issuers who remain and will be continuing to pay this fee, to what extent by what average percentage will their fees go up? You know that?
As noted previously, the amount assessed to the 1,100 issuers that would likely not receive a bill going forward, public companies, only 0.4% or less of the accounting support fee was allocated to that group. Similarly, for investment companies, which on average have only been assessed about 5% of the total accounting support fee, the total accounting support fee assessed to that group that would be excluded was only 0.3% of the accounting support fee.
This should almost be not noticeable.
Those tiny percentages would be redistributed over the other issuers, and the increases would be very minimal.
So this will be a tremendous saving both to those people and to us in terms of the administrative
correct
effort.
Yes.
All I have is to turn.
Board Member Hanson.
I have no formal statement or further questions other than to thank the staff and express my support for the proposal today.
If there's no further question, no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. Are all those in favor of approving the funding rule, please say aye.
Aye.
And any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carried. The rule is passed. Thank you to the staff again and to the board. That concludes our agenda. The meeting is now adjourned. And we can take perhaps a 5-minute break, a 10-minute break, and reconvene here for some non-public work. Thank you.